Welcome to the Board Game Barbecue, possibly the fastest growing board game community in the world. We are more than just a podcast. Join us on Discord to play games all the time with people from all over the world on platforms like Tabletop Simulator, Tabletopia, Board Game Arena, and any others. Join us in our Facebook community to discuss not only the topics of the week that come up in our podcast, but also the board game bracket and anything board games. But we still are a podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the show. The Board Game Barbecue, brought to you by Addicts, Not Experts. Hello and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue podcast. I'm your host, Steve, and tonight I'm joined by a few people. Firstly, we'll start with our regulars. We've got Sarah. How are you going?
I'm good, Steve. How are you?
Fantastic. And we've also got Dan. How are you going, Dan?
G'day, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. We were also joined by Sydney Engelstein, who has recently taken on a role, quite a substantial role at Stronghold Games. How are you going, Sydney?
I'm doing really well.
Excellent. Nice. Thank you for joining us on the show. And we're also joined by Nick Little, who has also has a fairly substantial role with Indie Boards and Cards. How are you going, Nick?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. Thank you both for being guests on the show. We much appreciate it. So if you are a first-time listener to the show, what we'll do is we'll start off in our topic of the week, which we'll be discussing with Sydney and Nick, their positions in the hobby, both the companies they work for and also the games they develop. Then we'll go from there into our sizzling games segment, where we'll talk about games that we've been all been getting to the table of late. And then we'll finish off by swearing an oath, which is where we promise to play a game off our shelf of shame before the next time we're on the show. But without further ado, we'll just get straight into it. I'll firstly start by saying congratulations, Sydney, on your newish role at Stronghold Games. Can you elaborate a little bit on how that came to be?
Yeah, thank you very much. So about 5 or 6 months ago, Stephen Bonacor, who I'm sure you've all heard of, decided to retire. And I had been working at Indie Game Studios as a developer and project manager for about a year and a half at that point. We decided, since we wanted somebody to make sure they were looking over all the Stronghold projects the way Steven did, even though everybody at Indie Game Studios kind of wears both hats, the development team sort of got split so that I'm making sure to look over all the projects from conception to, you know, the factory.
Cool.
Excellent. And Nick, would you like to elaborate a little bit on your role in the your business?
I thought you were going to ask me to elaborate on Sydney's role. I'd be like, yeah,
don't. He knows it.
That's good. You fill in for each other.
When she said, though, when I was just listening to you talk, Sydney, and you said that, like, after a year and a half, we promoted you to director of this, I was like, and she has such a high voice, people are going to think we promoted, like, a 12-year-old to this. But Sydney has been in and around Stronghold forever. We went to, there's a little convention in New Jersey called Metatopia that's for board game designers, primarily to show their new prototypes. We went, it was 2019, and Sydney knew, like, it was in New Jersey, which is her hometown, but she knew all of the Stronghold crew that was helping and had known them for years and years, and she's 24. Known her since she was like 12. So it was like this obvious inclusion. It was like promoting a part of the Stronghold family, basically. So it, like, made a ton of sense to put her into that position for us.
Yeah. I published my first game with Stronghold in like 2016, but since they're a homegrown New Jersey company and I've been going to the New Jersey board game convention since I was literally born, I've grown up with all of the people who work with the company. So I know how to work with them, and it's just a continuation of a longstanding relationship.
And you have a board gaming designer family as well, don't you, Sydney? Because I know that, like, I bought Space Cadets and I saw that, you know, it was a family design effort.
Yeah.
So how old were you then? You must have been very young.
I think I was 14 when we started working on the design of Space Cadets, and then more like 16 when it came out. My brother and dad designed together first. They made the Ares Project, which is not a very well-known card game, but it's one of those cult classics that people still play. And I watched them design it. And then when Space Cadets came up, I was like, I'm getting involved now. I'm in high school. I'm ready to design board games. which has always been really fun. So we designed all together through high school and then when I was in college also, even though it got a little harder because I was moved away.
The one that I love is the dragon and the flagon, which I've seen played, and it's incredible. Were there any sort of collaboration related sort of lessons that you learnt from working, the three of you working together on Space Cadets, that you could take when you worked on the Dragon and the Flagon a few years later?
I mean, I think that our collaboration has always been pretty set in stone. I mean, since we're a family, it wasn't like we started with Space Cadets. We've been working on communication our entire lives. So we have a very, built-in dynamic. I always like to say I'm very nice to the players. I try and make sure they're having fun. And my brother is very mean to the players. He wants everyone to struggle. And my dad balances and makes sure it's not a poor gaming experience one way or the other. But we definitely have learned a lot since Space Cadets. When I go back and read the rule book, I feel like I would never make a game like that now because I've learned so much about streamlining and like efficiency of space and clarity. And I still love to play Space Cadets, but the games I come out with now with Nick are just, I think, a lot more mature.
It's a fun game. I just remember teaching it. It was quite an ordeal because it's just, it's a different game for every crew member, right?
Yeah, it's like a series of mini games. So every different player has their own mini game to be their role on the ship. So one person is firing the weapons and they have a little flicking disc mini game, and another is the shields and they're making poker hands, which is a really fun concept. But for the weight of the game, it takes a long time to explain. Maybe one day, go back, make it better.
So, Nick, did you have a similar start in the board gaming industry? Were you playing games for a really long time?
So, I growing up, like, I played the standard kind of board game fare that, Parker Brothers, Monopoly. Yeah. The way more mainstream stuff, Atari and stuff like that. And then I didn't really play board games for a while. And I played Catan with some of my friends, but what got me into, being interested in gaming was I played Magic the Gathering. I started playing when I was 17, and I played well enough to play on their pro tour, their professional tournament scene.
Wow.
A few times. So I was really into that. And they have there's a format of Magic called Cube, where it's a drafting format, but you get to pick all the cards that go in to what the draft pool is. So normally in Magic, when you draft, you buy some packs and the company supplies you basically with the pool. But it gives you this gaming experience that you curate, right? So you're choosing to put these cards in the available pool because they work together or they counteract each other. So it is a design experience, curating a cube for an experience like that.
Yeah, sure.
That's what kind of got me to be starting off in the developing brain that I have now, or the developer brain that I have now. But the way I got into the industry was a very good friend of mine, Travis Chance, who is still in the industry as well. He designed a game. He was living in New York at the time. He designed a game and came to Gen Con, and I played the game with him, and then he and I ended up working on it for 3 months, and we ended up getting it published through another publisher. And then he moved to Indianapolis, and we started this company called Action Phase Games, and we kickstarted a game called Heroes Wanted, and it did way better than we thought. He quit his job. A year later, we kickstarted the expansion. It did well enough that I quit my job, and then this was all we did, is started making games. And within a year and a half or so, we got the offer from Indie Boards and Cards to buy us out, basically, and come work for Travis Worthington, the owner of Indie Boards and Cards. And that's when I became the director of development and production for Indie Boards and Cards. And then a couple of years after that, which would be 2 years ago now, is when Indie Boards and Cards merged with Stronghold Games, and I became the VP of production and development for Indie Game Studios.
That's quite a success story. It sounds like it sort of blew up, really, because
it really did.
People's first Kickstarters don't do better than they expected, in a lot of cases they don't fund at all. So that's amazing.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough that we were still on that front end of when Kickstarter was getting popular. you know, for board gaming. There were definitely some successes at the time, but it was like 2014, I think, is when Heroes 1 had hit. And I thought it looked great, and it was a great concept, and it was funny. And I thought we were going to make about 50 grand. I think our funding goal was 28, and we made 128. Or 130 wow. or something like that. So it did a lot better than we thought. And then when we went to Gen Con that year, we barely got the games in time to get to Gen Con. They were literally delivered to a parking lot 2 miles from my house because the semi wouldn't drop a pallet at my house. It couldn't get down the road of my neighborhood. So we drove our cars to this parking lot, unloaded these skids into our cars, like taking box by box, and then drove. Fortunately, like I live in Indianapolis and that's where Gen Con is. So we just drove all the extra stuff to my house and left it there and then drove the rest downtown to the convention. It was literally like Wednesday at 4 p.m. when this happened, with Gen Con starting at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning.
Oh, wow.
And so you would have been really calm and in control at that point.
Oh yeah, for sure. But it was one of those things where like we were the talk, like we were one of the talks of Gen Con. Like we were number one on the BGG hotness for that weekend. We sold like 230 games, which is a huge number for a new company at Gen Con, especially when our game was like $60. You know, it wasn't like an easy $20 sell. It was like $60, and then with the little expansions, it was like an $85 bundle or something. We sold almost entirely bundles. So yeah, we did really well. And then we sold out into distribution like immediately. So yeah, it really was quite fortunate that we struck a chord with people with that game.
Yeah. Was that a card game, did you say?
It was a card-driven game with a board. The kind of base concept is you play these wannabe superheroes that live in a town where like the main team, like the Avengers of that city, somebody has retired, and you're all trying to like get in the newspaper so that like they'll pick you to replace him. So it's like American Idol meets the Avengers, the kind of pitch. Yeah. So it's really funny. You start by like drawing a body and a head card, drawing three bodies and three heads, and you pick which body and head you want to go together. And then each have like an adjective. The bodies have an adjective and the heads have a noun. So your superhero name comes together when you put them there. Pork Ninja, or, you know, like the Green Phantom, you know, and like, so the outfits look ridiculous because it's all mixed matched and everything. Yeah, it's funny. It's a good time.
And you're just going around saving cats out of trees and stuff, are you?
Yeah, there's four boards with four scenarios, and the first one is literally called Littering, Loitering, and Looting. And it's a guy who keeps like dropping trash on the ground, and he's jaywalking is one of the things too. And
that's outrageous.
It's absurd. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
So I've got a question for both of you actually. When a game when you see a game in your companies, your respective parts of your umbrella company looks at this game, do you have like a thing inside where you're like, oh, I really want this one to do well. I really like this one. Is there an issue with like favoritism, or do your personal taste, do you just have to push aside your personal tastes and just treat every game the same?
I think for the most part, we make games that we really want to play.
Yeah.
I think that there are sometimes games that, because Sydney and I are both of similar tastes, where we like co-op games, where there's like a lot of discussion and you're working together to do something. And those games can be a little bit longer. But on the other side, we like kind of lighter games, still with a lot of like social interaction. Some of the games that Stronghold publishes don't really fall into that group, but most of those games we don't end up working on. They're like really popular games in Germany or France or whatever, and we end up getting the license rights for. At which point we play them a few times and we may like amend the rule book some, but we don't really do very much development on those games. And even a lot of those games, like when we got Nova Luna, I was like, this isn't normally my style of game, but I really like this game. I hope it does really well. And it is done. Yeah,
it's a great game. And it did do really well.
Yeah, it has. But
we also don't we don't get the chance to get really attached to those kinds of games. Because even though I enjoy playing Nova Luna, you know, we played it once, maybe twice, just to make sure it was something we wanted to get the license for. Whereas our Indie Boards and Cards games that we, you know, sign a contract with the designer, we can work on those for months and months and months at a time, you know, playing it every single day. So then I start to get a feeling of like, oh, this is like our baby, our game that we put so much work into.
So was Nova Luna quite polished when it came to already, and that's why you just knew that it was good fit for you guys?
Yeah, for sure. It was one where the only really questions we had were about like wording in the rule book, and we actually did kind of a substantial job on the English translation rule book to make sure things were a lot clearer and providing more examples than were in the original rule book. Like, but none of the rules changed; they were just clarified on some of our initial questions. So.
And one thing I've always wanted to know is when a game like Nova Luna gets nominated for the Spiel des Jahres and there's a lot of buzz, what kind of impact does that have on the company?
It really depends. And I think that the Spiel had a lot more impact in years past than it does now. I think it's kind of hard to tell. Like when Nova Luna was nominated, we were just running out of stock on like the initial print run that we had ordered. So when we reordered it, by the time we got it back in, it was like just about when the pandemic started. So like, I don't know that we've seen a real sales boost from it. It's kind of hard to tell. Also, like, to be completely honest with you, like, I know when a game gets reprinted, but I don't look at the sales. Like, I'm not part of marketing and sales being, you know, part of the production development. So a lot of what Sydney and I do is like when we submit the files and then we get the like first print sample and we're like, this is done, it's out of our hands after that. It's on to a different part of the company. So
now, look, it's no coincidence that we've asked the two of you to come on. Obviously you work closely together, but one of the probably the bigger collaborations that you've worked on would be the Aeon's End story. Can we get probably start with Nick on that one about your journey with Aeon's End?
Yeah, so Aeon's End was I think the game that sealed the deal for Action Phase getting bought by Indie Boards and Cards. It was a game where it was shown to us at Origins, which is a bigger gaming show here in the States. And it was like the second year that Action Phase was a thing. It was the second year that we were at. It might have been the first year we went to Origins. It was the first year we went to Origins, because the first year Origin happened, we didn't have copies of the game yet. And we were introduced to, by some other designers, we were introduced to the designer of Aeon's End. His name is Kevin Riley. And he showed us the game, and we liked it, because Travis Chance and I, are both big deck building fans. And Kevin came from a background of, he was a pro StarCraft player. Like, he streamed and he played in all the big tournaments. And he showed us this game and we really liked it. But it was a one versus one game where you were both mages firing spells at each other. And it was super grindy. It had this mechanic where you could buy a card and put it into your opponent's deck, 'cause it was like kind of bad. And we played it a bunch and we still liked it, but I just went, Kevin, I just don't know who the audience for this game is. I really like it, but I think that like most people that play deck builders, they want to draw a bunch of cards. They want to have a bunch of fun. They want to generate a bunch of numbers. They don't want to like grind out incremental advantages against somebody. And it was also because of the non-randomness of the situation where there's no shuffling. It was a game where the better player always won because they knew what to do earlier in the game.
Right. Yep.
And it was impossible to catch back up. And we told him that, and he was like, okay, well, give me some time to think about it. And I was like, okay. And he's a really smart guy, and we wanted to work with him kind of based on him and based on where he had started. And he came back to us, and he was like, I was thinking about the fact that you were talking about it, like, it's really grindy. It's kind of hard to figure out what you're supposed to do and all this stuff. And he was like, I compared it to other games that were like that. And he's like, League of Legends is super grindy. Like, it is really hard to get good at that game. And he named a bunch of all these other games. And I was like, Kevin, all those games you're talking about are all cooperative. Like, you have a team. And that's where we were like, oh, that's it. You can make this grindy game that's hard to kind of figure out what you need to do if you're all working together to figure it out. If a better player can tell the weaker player, hey, maybe you want to do this because of this, and then they can learn and work together and help each other out. And then, so that's when we made the nemesis that you fight against. And just from there, we just came up ideas on how we would implement that stuff. And Travis Chance was the guy who came up with the world initially. He's very creative, as you can tell from looking at the art and everything that's going on there. And he created the world that was in, and he came up with, it was his idea to do the random turn order deck.
Kevin, such yeah. a cool idea.
And then almost all of the games, Kevin and I worked basically hand in hand to design. So I'm credited as like the lead developer on most of them, because he ends up doing like most of the work, because I have other stuff to do. And Anzen was honestly like his full-time job for a long time. And then he just got a job about a year ago, working at this software company, like that helps with mobile, that work, they make mobile games, and he makes the, like the pieces that help the developers do what they need to do to make the games.
Okay. Well, it was interesting because, I'm a huge fan of, I've been calling it Aeon's End, but you're saying Aeon's End. So now I'll be saying it correctly from now on. I'm a huge fan of Aeon's End. And actually the funny thing is the first game when it came out, for one reason or another, I think I must have read that it was about, you know, fighting this nemesis and like fighting the bad guys. And I just, something in my brain just assumed that it was a dungeon crawler. I don't know why. And yeah, it's weird. I don't know why. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to keep away from that. Not that I don't like dungeon crawlers, but I don't play them that much with my partner, but we're huge deck building fans. So when you guys released the legacy version, and it was just like a big black box, like it's so plain, which is funny because all of the art in Aeon's End is so colorful and this box is just black. But I don't know who was in charge of the marketing, but it was brilliant because it said a co-op deck building game underneath, and it was so bright because of the black background. I went, what? Why did I just assume this was a dungeon crawler? That's so silly. And then I went ahead and basically bought everything because it's just a fantastic game. Like, yeah, I absolutely love deck builders. Hands
that
down,
line is on every
works
box.
So well. Is it? Yeah, yeah, I honestly don't know.
When you said you love the marketing, I threw my hands up in the air because that cover is my idea. I am not the art guy ever. I'm usually like, I know what I like, I know what I hate, and then that, and that's, but that's only 10% of art. Like the rest of the 90%, I'm like, I don't really care. It's fine. I never do art. And I was like, for Legacy, I just want it to be bold. I want it to just be black and then the logo. And then if you look under the logo, which nobody has like really ever noticed, but it's actually a panorama of the art of all the nemesis.
Oh,
make
okay.
up the letters, and then it has like, it has the coloration of the logo over it, but it's kind of a, that was my initial idea too, is we would just cut out the word Aeon's End over the panorama of that. But right. It didn't really look right without the coating of the yellow, red, orange, whatever it is. So it gets kind of washed out, but it's under there somewhere.
That's cool. I'm going to have a look at the box after this. So Sydney, how did you come on board the Aeon's End? Did you play it and you loved it and wanted to be part of it?
I had actually never played Aeon's End before. When I was applying to work at indie game studios, I was mostly applying through the Stronghold side because that's who I knew. I knew Steven. I asked him about job openings because I was just graduated from college and I wanted to work in the industry. And Stronghold Games had merged with Indie Boards and Cards. Well, they had, you know, been discussing it for a while, but they had just announced it at Gen Con that they were going to merge. And I was at that Gen Con and I was hanging out with Steven and I said, does merging mean you're going to have more job openings? And he said, maybe. Here's my email. We can talk about it after. And so then I started in on the interviewing process for the developer project manager position. And I did a whole bunch of stuff, some interviews. I worked on another prototype that the company had, doing like development on it solo, so they could see how I worked on games. And then eventually I got to the point where Nick was like, we want to see how you work with the team. So we'll fly you out to Indiana for a week to do a week of in-person development just to make sure there's no personality conflict, because we spend a ton of time together and we all kind of have to get along and want to play board games together. In addition to, are you smart and good at developing games, which is obviously important too. And before I came, Nick mailed me a copy of Aeon's End. And he basically just said, you're gonna want to know how to play this game. This is going to be the majority of what we do. You're going to have to be familiar with Aeon's End. And I had the opposite reaction to you, Sarah, because I actually do not like deck builders. One of my less preferred genres of games. So when I saw that and Nick was like, this is, you know, most of what our work is, I was like, oh no, I'm not a huge deck builder person. And then I played Aeon's End once and I was just so taken with it. It's one of my favorite games from the beginning. Mm. And then I came out and they were in the middle of what is now Aeon's End the New Age. They were right near the end of it where they had all the mages and all the nemeses mostly locked down, but they were still playtesting the final parts of it. So I got to playtest that with them and it was just so much fun. And obviously I loved the people. I really enjoy playing games with Nick. So
that's really
very lucky. Yeah. So I'm just working on Aeon's End is definitely the highlight of my time there. And I always try and, you know, I feel like I'm much more attached to Aeon's End than any of the other games in our catalog, which makes sense because we spend like 9 months of the year hardcore focusing on it. I really love the game. But my favorite part of the game is the story.
I was going to ask you about that because you had a hand in the most recent one, didn't you? Outcasts, you're both credited as designing it with Kevin Riley. What was that experience like?
So like I said, when I was hired onto the company, they were pretty close to the end of New Age, so I worked with them on it a little, but my development hand in New Age, I didn't have much to do with it because it was almost done. But what wasn't really almost done is the expedition narrative. So for those of you who don't know, Aeon's End is they're individual fights where you play cooperatively against a boss. But the more recent games that came out, starting with New Age, have what's called the expedition system, where the bosses that are packaged in the box are ordered within a little story, like a little adventure, and your characters unlock treasures and you get new ones and you get new market cards to buy and put into your deck the farther along you progress, you know, fighting boss to boss to boss, and the bosses become harder. So it forms a little tiny story out of all these individual fights. And there's also a written narrative that goes along with it and tells you what's happening and explains, you know, what's happening to the characters and how they're coming across these monsters. And as Nick mentioned, Travis Chance, his old partner, he was very creative and he sort of single-handedly made so much of the world of Aeon's End. And he had recently left the company before I came on. So there was somewhat of a story in place that he had written, but nobody was really able to take it over because both Nick and Kevin aren't really writers. And I love creative writing. So I was like, I could take a stab at it. And I wrote the main New Age expedition with Kevin. We worked together on it. And then I wrote all of the Outcast narrative. Mostly on my own. And now I'm working on the narrative of the new Aeon's End Legacy of Gravehold that's in production right now.
I was going to ask you about that.
So tell us about that.
Oh, and full disclosure, just before you start, at the Board Game Barbecue last year, at the end of last year, we wrapped up the year by doing our top 10s. Sarah, Aeon's End was your number
two.
And it's my number one. So we're both fanning out right now. Please tell us.
We're trying not to gush about Aeon Zen.
I'm trying to be very reserved about all of this Aeon Zen discussion. Steve, if you want to go get a cup of coffee, we might be a while.
Yeah, that's. I kind of figured I wouldn't say a lot this episode. So.
But Sydney, please tell us you've got more stuff in the works.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like I said, Aeon's End is sort of a year-round occupation for us. Mm-hmm. Over the Christmas holidays, when we take off, we do a lot of brainstorming of mages and nemeses, ideas, just random things, anything that comes to us. And then we already get started with it right in the beginning of the next year. So early, we'll probably start again the cycle in February or March. And then it's a ton of playtesting and mocking up and figuring out exactly what we want the game to be. So Aeon Zen 6 has already been through almost a full year of work with me and Nick, and we're really proud of it.
It was about a year ago when Sydney came back from break. We had a meeting and she goes, okay, here's my idea document. Keep in mind, I woke up from a fever dream and wrote down some of these things. And I'm like a fan of simplicity, so every time she pitches me something with more than four lines of text, she goes, you're gonna hate this one. There's an idea for a nemesis, and it's just, what if he makes you set stuff on fire?
Like real things in your house that you have to burn. Really,
like, Sydney, we can't send something with a book of matches. Like, we can't sell a game. Just burn something on your house.
But the immersion.
Right.
Yeah, the sense of
urgency as well.
Yeah, you would really not want that nemesis to beat you.
You really wouldn't. That's true.
The reason Nick and I make such a good team is, like, almost all of the ideas that I wrote down were nearly that crazy. But also, like, 80% of them are bosses or mages in the final Aeon's End. Nick is just so good at hearing me say, okay, what if there was a boss who was just a big pile of slime and he became smaller piles of slime, like little gloop globs? And then he's like, oh, yeah, here's the mechanics that we can mock up around that. And we're, like, playtesting gloop globs by the end of the day. So he's very practical-minded.
That is awesome. I love that. Well, that makes sense because there's so much diversity in the game, like with the mages, with the nemesis. Like, I know basically everyone I've talked to about Aeon's End has said everyone, like every battle is so different, and there's just so much variety as well with the supply cards you buy. Yeah, there's no fight that's ever the same. Actually, I've got a question in relation to that. With all these new versions coming out, are you always sort of going to make sure that everything's compatible together, or do you see it sort of taking a diversion where it might not be backwards compatible anymore?
So I think the framework of the game will always make it compatible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we're likely to change the framework of the game in that sort of way. We are working on a version of Aeon's End that's it's a little bit, it's changed, it's different, and it's not going to be Aeon's End. It's set in a whole different world, but at its core, you're deck building, you're not shuffling, you're fighting a nemesis, but some of the setup time is taken away as the supply is randomized stacks instead of you picking 9 stacks to go in.
Wow.
And the nemesis deck is much smaller, but when it runs out, he gets you shuffle the cards back up and he gets like a new ability, so he like tears up. Instead of you having to take the time, because the most time consuming part of setting up and tearing down Aeon's End is the nemesis deck and the supply. So we shot to just take those out and in that game, and then approach it from what if we made this appeal to like a wider audience as far as the theme of the game and the art and stuff like that. So taking a lot of the stuff that we've learned also complexity wise in general from Aeon's End, because you know, when you put a game out there and it's so well received and there's so many people, like you can see from just Aeon's End to New Age, how many rules didn't necessarily change, but kind of morphed some, you know, especially like the turn order deck, like the way that it used to be in 4 players, there was just 1 turn order card for each player. And then I think it was in War Eternal, we introduced the 1/2 and the 3/4 player turn order cards. Yep. So you have the option there, and it makes three, four players a little easier. You can see that kind of evolution as we heard from people and we saw lots of people play. Because it's obviously like, as soon as your game, if you have a Kickstarter that has 2,000 backers, once you've delivered a month, like 2 weeks after that, people have played your game more than you ever have. You know, like,
right.
Like 2,000 people have played your game once. That's 10 times more than I played it in playtesting easily.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Like,
so they're going to find stuff and they're going to have different experiences and so on. But as far as like compatibility for Aeon's End, I think there are some things that we're not afraid to design stuff that you can't use. You know what I mean? It's like, so for example, with Outcasts, you have some of the cards that care about you using the Zaxos Outcast module part of the game. So if you're just going to play a random one-off game and you don't want to play with Zaxos, you won't want to use those cards. But I really have a hard time us imagining like making more Aeon's End branded products like within the line and going, yeah, you can't use this with other stuff. So I would say that we're just going to continue to grow that line and design more stuff. It probably and inevitably will get more complicated. And it kind of has over time anyway. Like the first box has the simplest guys. Well, the first box and Legacy both have the simplest nemeses. But Legacy was built as an introductory product. So like, I'm glad that's where you started, Sarah, because that was, that's, we were like, people are going to see Legacy. People who like Legacy games are going to look at this game when they would have never looked at Aeon's End.
Yeah, I actually, sorry, I was just going to say that when people tell me which one should I start with, I'm always like Legacy, because it just does such a great job of introducing the rules.
That's what we say too. When people, you know, at a convention, they see six Aeon's End boxes, they get a little overwhelmed. We go, start with Legacy because it brings in the mechanics slowly one at a time and it just naturally teaches you how to play the game.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
From an outsider looking in, that's exactly how I feel. It's if I have looked at Aeon's End Legacy, picked up the box and decided whether or not to purchase, but I've never picked up another Aeon's End box. So it makes sense that, like you say, that Legacy term draws people in, because I've played Pandemic Legacy, I've played, you know, Gloomhaven, and I've played these Legacy games. So the idea of jumping into a story-driven campaign game will bring more people than just another game that you might not be familiar with.
Yeah. But then on the other end of the spectrum, like Nick was saying about it getting more complicated, Aeon's End Legacy of Gravehold is definitely the most complicated game in the line so far. And it's not really intended to be a beginner piece. It's very much for the core Aeon's End audience that we've built up, who really know the game and know how to play and are longing to bite their teeth into mages and nemeses with heightened complexity. And I think it's going to be that way moving forward, not just because we have such a strong audience who like that complexity, but also because, you know, how many mages and nemeses do we have designed now? You know, 40 different mages. And
oh, wow.
Necessarily, you're going to need to find more and more interesting things to do. So they'll need more components or more twisted mechanics. You can't, you know, in the original Aeon's End, there were people whose ability was just gain life. And once you've done that, you can't go back to that. So you have to keep kind of figuring out new, more complex ways to make the characters all play in really individual ways.
Okay, Sydney, my wallet's out already. So when is it coming out?
The Kickstarter will be near the end of February.
Okay, cool. So fairly soon.
Yeah, fairly soon. And I'm going to warn your wallet that this is going to be the most expensive Aeon's End game yet. But it also has more than double the content of a regular Aeon's End game. We started brainstorming this. You know, we went to the owner of the company, Travis, and Sydney and I were pitching him different ideas for what we could do for this one. After doing a Legacy game and then two Expedition games, I was like, I don't know if we should go back to Expedition. It feels like we've done two of these now and we could keep doing that, but it just feels like we should do something fresh again. And we pitched him the idea of Legacy, and he was like, it sounds like you guys are most excited about Legacy. And I was like, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so he said, go ahead with that. And I said, okay, Sydney, what do you want to do for this. And
so you remember like 10 minutes ago,
when
10 minutes ago when we said I come up with crazy ideas and fever dreams and then Nick just actually does them? That's
yeah.
You had to do that on the spot.
She was like, well, what if we brought back like 25 characters and you could play them all as mages? And I was like, let's write it down. She's like, what if you played like you could, there was like 9 fights and there were branching paths and there were some nemeses you would never see unless you did this thing and this other. And I'm like, write it down. But this is like way more content than we've ever done. And she's like, and what if this happened and this happened? I was like, I put it down. And I like basically never said no. Usually it's my job to go, this is way too expensive. We can't do it. And in a way, we found some ways around it. But at the end of the day, this is going to be like at least $100 MSRP box. But it is like 20, it is 21 mages. And the normal Kickstarter for Aeon's End has 12 and is like 80, I think it's like $70. You know, it has 12 mages, usually has 12 mages and like 7 nemeses. And this one has 11 nemeses and 21 mages and way more, like definitely double the player cards.
I am pumped.
Yeah, same here. Same here.
I just want to know. Project. Is one of the stretched goals a box of matches?
Limited edition.
Darn health and safety requirements.
Gonna have to start like letting our insurance companies know that we own this game before we like, quote us on our contents insurance.
The thing for Legacy of Greyfold for me, and you know, a little bit of the rationale behind why I suggested such insane things, is that for people who've played all the Aeon's End content and love Aeon's End and maybe love the story the way I do, it's all been building up the story that began in the original Legacy and then continued through New Age and its expansions and then into Outcasts, really reaches ahead in Legacy of Greyfold. It's kind of the climax of this story arc. And I know that people, you know, they love the characters and they all have characters that they love and it's all different. And I wanted to give people the opportunity to see a story that was really built on the characters that they already care about and built in the world that they care about and bringing it all together. So at first we were like, well, maybe, you know, we'll mention other, you know, mages, but we'll only have a certain number that you can play. But as we went, we just kept saying, oh, well, we can just, you know, try and design, you know, maybe if we manage to think of a good design for this mage, we'll throw them in too. And maybe if we have a good design for this mage, we'll throw them in too. And in the end, I think, you know, it just goes to show how much Nick and I, and hopefully everybody else, we really love the characters and we wanted to give them all a chance to have spotlight in the story before we move on to sort of the next storyline of Aeon's End, whatever that ends up being.
For sure. That sounds awesome.
Well, I think we'll probably wrap up the topic of the week there. That was some really awesome stuff, getting a you know, Kickstarter exclusive. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Actually, from someone who doesn't own any Aeon's End content right now, I'm a bit like you, Sydney. I'm a little bit over deck builders, to be fair. I played a lot of Dominion and I didn't really get into Clank. I've got a few other deck builders, but it wasn't really my style of game. But after hearing you guys talk for the last 15 minutes about that, I am so keen to go and suss out any of this content, let alone the upcoming Kickstarter. That sounds awesome.
One of us. One of us. One of us.
Oh, and one thing as well I will mention, because a lot of people, when they hear Legacy, they think one and done. And the Aeon's End stuff is not one and done. You can do it. You go back. You can kill all the nemeses again at increased difficulty, which is what me and my partner did, like straight away as soon as it was finished. And then you can combine all your stuff with all the other Aeon's End packs, which is awesome, because a lot of people sort of, you know, they get turned off by that one and done and it's over kind of thing. So anyway.
So I love what you're saying, obviously. Sarah, is that I need to get my purchase pen out now.
Yeah, get your purchase pen out.
Yeah. All right, so we'll move on, though. We'll move into our next segment, which is Sizzling Games. Sydney and Nick, are you guys okay to stick around for that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so our Sizzling Games, if you haven't been listening before, this is just a segment where we talk about games that we've been getting to the table lately that we are interested in. This might be a little bit hard for Sydney and Nick because it sounds like you guys play a lot of the same game over and over and over again. So it'll be interesting, but I might throw it down to Melbourne first and start with Dan. What have you been playing, Matt, lately?
I've been, well, outside of Aeon's End, but I think we've had enough Aeon's End talk for today. I just played Outcast last night. It's so good. I've been playing a lot of Mr. Jack. Now, this is an old game. I didn't actually realize how old it was, so I checked BGG. 2006, Bruno Cathala game, and I've been playing it on Board Game Arena. But I've rediscovered my love of sort of deduction sleuthy games. When I got the Loot of Lima Kickstarter at the end of last year and was playing that for a bit, it just reminded me that I love those sort of Clue and those sort of games. And Mr. Jack is a two-player game, and it is set in the city of London, and it's the board is a map of hexagonal tiles, and there's a few little buildings scattered around, and then there are some lampposts, and there are eight characters. And the eight characters are Sherlock Holmes, Watson, Inspector Lestrade, and five others as well. And they all have different roles and different actions when you move them. But the object of the game is that one of the eight characters is Jack the Ripper. And it's you play against someone else. One person will be the detective, one person will be Jack the Ripper, and they'll pull a card of the eight and they'll know which one is Jack the Ripper. But you take turns in moving all eight characters in two rounds. And it's such a it's one of the best cat and mouse style games that I've played in a long time. Now, like I said, I'm playing on Board Game Arena, so I'm playing against randoms, and I'm about 50-50, I think, win-loss. I'm slowly getting better, but I love that deduction part of trying to work out which of the eight characters is Jack the Ripper. And the way you do that is in the first round of two, there are only four characters available, and between the two players, you move two each. And then at the end of the round, if a character is next to another character, or if a character is next to a lamppost in the city, then they are technically seen or they are visible. And so what the Jack the Ripper character has to reveal, but in BGA it just reveals it automatically for you, is whether Jack the Ripper is seen or unseen. So when you play the Jack the Ripper player, you're trying to make sure that all the characters at the end of the round are visible, so that the detective gets no information. And the detective is trying to, I think the best strategy I've found is trying to split them out a little bit. So you've got some characters that are seen, some unseen, so that when you find out whether Jack is seen or unseen, you've pretty much culled a few of the characters and you've eliminated some of them from suspicion. It's just a real cat and mouse. There's some of the, as I said, the characters each have a particular action. So, for instance, there is a guy whose job it is to move lamps. So you can, after you move him, you can move one lamppost from one side of the city to the other. So suddenly some of the characters were under the light of the lamp are now in the dark. The Sherlock Holmes character, after you move him, you actually take another card off the deck. So you keep that information to yourself, but that's another suspect that you can eliminate as being Jack the Ripper. And there are also four exits. So to win the game, you need to, if you're the Jack the Ripper character, if you're playing Jack the Ripper, you need to, A, be able to exit the city, but you can only do that after the Jack the Ripper has been determined as unseen. So you really got to, you're trying to keep them in the light and keep them away from suspicion from the detective as long as you can. But at the point where suddenly they are in the dark, then you need to make it to the exit. But the trouble is the detective can also place barricades and move barricades around the city as well. So, like I said, the cat and mouse element is just fantastic. The game still plays fairly quickly, probably 15, 20 minutes. Sometimes I get a bit of AP, and so the game might take a bit longer, but usually BGA starts beeping telling you that it's your turn, hurry up. Or the other person you're playing against is going, come on, come on. But I'm really enjoying it. I don't own the physical copy, so I just watched a few playthroughs on YouTube, and then I thought, look, I'll just jump in and learn as I go. And I had some pretty hefty losses, but then watching how other people were playing, I started to develop a bit of a strategy. And yeah, I love it. I love the deduction and the strategy part of it. And for a game that's, like I said, 2006, 14, nearly 15 years old, I mean, it's Bruno Cathala, so yeah, there's a great pedigree there, but still holds up. It's a great game.
Yeah, I've been curious about that one for a while because I love just two-player games and deduction games. So, yeah, I'll have to give it a try. I didn't know it was on VGA. Is that when they did the Christmas special and they released
it? I think it came out in December before the – yeah, but, yeah, it's very recent.
Cool. I'll have to give it a go.
All right, so Mr. Jack, I'll go back overseas and I'll ask Nick. Nick, what have you been playing lately?
I've actually played a lot of The Crew. Have you guys played The Crew?
Yes,
it's a great game.
Yeah, I got it because I had heard of, like, when I read about it, I was like, this sounds interesting. I like games like that. I got it, and initially, because of, you know, the pandemic and stuff, I was just playing with my girlfriend. So we were using the kind of dummy third player, and which I think is really easy. Like, it's, you have so much information about where the cards are that it's easy to go through all of them. And then, like, the first time I got the opportunity to play it with more than that, I played it when I went to Thanksgiving with my immediate family. We played it five-handed, and not everybody at the table was like an average trick-taking game player, and like two or three of the people didn't want to count cards, and the game gets really hard if you're not counting cards.
Especially five.
So we definitely had a hard time then. And then at Christmas, I played four-handed with two of my family members that weren't gamers but had played a lot of trick-taking games. So they were able to count some of the cards and at least understood a lot of the strategy involved. So we played it for a while. I was surprised. My family members were like, no, let's play the next one. No, we got to beat this one. Let's try it again. You know, so yeah. I like that game a lot. I love that it takes trick-taking and turns it on its head. It has all the same mechanics as your generic trick-taking game would trump, right? And then it says, except you don't just want to take all the tricks, right? You need to figure out where this goes. And it's always the weird ones, you know, where you're like, you have the two of blue and you have to take the two of blue. And you're like, oh my God, how are we going to orchestrate this situation where I have the lead and this is the only blue card left, you know, like... So I think that's really interesting. I enjoy the challenge. I know that definitely some of my family members got frustrated when those situations would come up and they go, how do we ever do that? You know? And it's like, well, when it clicks with them and we accomplish it, it's such a great high, you know, like you feel so clever that you figured out how to do it. So it's, I like the game a lot.
I get dirty looks from my partner sometimes. Like you just know he's saying, why did you play that? my memory for counting cards isn't as good as his.
It is interesting at four. It's definitely a different experience at four or five than it is at three. I found with three, the game itself seems to be a little bit easier. But when you get those higher play counts, and like you said, Nick, I was a bit the same when I first played it. I played with two people who had never played trick-taking games, and then two of us had. So it was almost this other game where we were trying to set things up and then watching them fall down and having to rethink how we... but then recently I just played it with three other people who are trick-taking players. Like usually 500 is the big game that we all have played in the past. And we just smashed through like the first 15 chapters before we actually made an error. But then we just got stuck on this one for a good four or five rounds. So even at those higher play counts, even with good players, it is quite tricky when you get like a board full of the same color card that you've got to try and win tricks for. And
Have you played through all 50 scenarios, Steve?
No, 35 we got to, so I haven't finished it yet.
Nick, have you clocked it?
My girlfriend and I got to 41 or 42, I think is where we are. But like I said, it's so much easier two-handed because you know where half the cards are. So you basically know where all the cards are. Like there's only seven cards initially hidden from you, and those start to get revealed. So it's a lot easier. So
yeah, I find when I play with my wife, we get a bit of a rhythm going, a bit of mind meld happening, and we can usually get through quite a few scenarios in a row before we hit a hurdle. But yeah, you sort of really got to sort of be in sync and be familiar with each other's sort of play patterns. But I love it. I love just the way you're essentially gaming the game, aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite stressful though, because you really don't want to be that person who has ruined the setup, like you said, Steve. People set things up, and you don't want to be that person that completely ruins it. So, yeah.
Yeah,
I found it really daunting playing in a group of people that do know how to play trick-taking games. Because I'm like, I hope I'm reading this correctly. I actually took a lot longer to play my turns because I needed to make sure that I was getting everything from the table that I could get. And you just don't want to be it. Like you say, you don't want to be that guy who's, oh, sorry, everyone. Let's try again.
Well, you lead out and then you just hold your breath and make sure that everyone else understands what your intentions are by playing that card.
Sorry, Nick, I cut you off there before.
Oh, no, I was going to bring up that, you know, how like a lot of co-op games have like an alpha player problem where like the best player can just play off the whole game for you.
Yes.
I feel like Crew and other games like Hanabi and stuff where you're not allowed to communicate has the opposite, right? Where they have like an Omega player problem where you'll never do better than your worst player can play. You know, where you're just like, you're not card counting, you don't understand trick taking games, and you have an important card, we're never going to win.
And you have a memory like a goldfish.
Fantastic. Oh, you need to win the 7, and it's your only 7 in that color. I'm going to lead the 9 of that suit. That's going to work.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I might jump in there with my sizzling game. I had the chance to play this with another member of the podcast, Adrian, and a couple of our community members the other day, and that was City of the Big Shoulders. Any of you guys played this game before?
No.
Okay, cool. So this game, it's an economic game where it's such a great setting. It's set in the 1880s, 1890s in Chicago. And you're basically taking ownership of these companies that are real companies, and some of them are still active today, which is very cool. You immediately sort of I went to Spalding because I'm a basketball fan, and I'm like, "Ooh, I'll buy Spalding." But there was also like Cracker Jack, Quaker Oats, Florsheim Shoes. There's all these companies that you're kind of somewhat familiar with, probably more familiar if you live in the US. But anyway, you take control of these companies and you basically are trying to gain the most personal wealth. That's the winner of the game is the person with the most personal wealth at the end. But to get personal wealth, it's a bit of a, like the game kind of makes you think what you're trying to do is build your company up to make the company successful. But it doesn't matter how much money your company's got go in its pool at the end of the game, that doesn't help you in the game. So you've got to try and work out ways to take money from your company into your own personal pool, which, and you can't be dodgy. You've got to do it the right way. So you've got to pay dividends to shareholders. But the problem with that is that other people can they can invest in your company as well. So, for example, I mentioned Spalding before. I had a 30% share, which is what you get when you buy a company, a 30% share in that company. But Dave also bought a 30% share of my company. So every time I paid out, he got the same amount of money in his personal wealth as I did. So then I was like, well, what do I do with this company? Do I really try and push this because I'm just helping someone else at the table now? Or do I kind of dump it and get another company and try and start again and get that heavier, higher investment rate? So it really is a bit of a, probably sounding boring to a lot of people because maybe a lot of people aren't into investment strategy, but I loved it. It was such a great game. The player interaction for that reason, someone buys a new company mid-game and everyone just absolutely ransacks it for all of its shares because it's cheap and all the other companies are now worth a lot more. So get in while it's cheap and hope it succeeds sort of thing. For example, Shane had a shoe. He had Florsheim shoes, and I invested heavily in that. And that I think that actually won me the game because towards the end, his was the most valuable company, and he was producing the most amount of units, which meant more money was going back to its investors. And while he was doing well, I was doing almost as well as him. I think I had a 40% share, so I just kept on getting more and more money that I wasn't necessarily having to do anything for.
Mm.
So that was really cool. I really enjoyed that idea of being able to, jump on the back of others, I guess. But the other thing that I really like about it, which is more of the worker placement style of the game, and that is that at the start of the game, you've got these places you can put your workers, and there's 7 positions you can go, or maybe 11, actually 11 positions you can go to, and you've each got two workers. So in an eight, in a four player game, eight of those spots are going to go. There's only two spaces that more than one person can go to as well. And they all give you some benefit. But then every round you draw a few tiles and you choose one tile to add to the next space of the board, so that the amount of spaces that you can go to is growing every round by four. But what's interesting about that decision is whatever tile you choose to be the new worker placement place that you're going to put out on your line, you get a benefit whenever anyone goes there.
Okay, cool.
So you're kind of sitting there going, it's a bit of a push and pull. You get a really valuable tile and you go, if I put this out, someone else is going to go there and get this really excellent benefit. That being said, if I put it out, I'm going to get money into my personal wealth. So do I want to focus on the fact that I'll get money from this, or do I want to focus on the fact that I don't want to give this ability to everyone else at the table? Which I found a really interesting push and pull. Sometimes you just ditched a tile because it was too strong, even though it was going to pay you a lot of money. And sometimes then you put out a tile that was weak and no one went there, so it was a waste. You're never going to get anything from that. So it just forces you to make a good decision around that. And the fact that that also means that every time you play this game, the places that you can put your workers is going to change based on the people you are playing with, which is really cool. It was a really nifty idea. I hadn't really seen that much before. So, it's City of the Big Shoulders. It's a pretty long game. It took us a few hours, and that was with a teach, in fairness, so maybe a bit less once you get used to it. Apparently it is on BGA too, Dan, so I'm pretty keen to play it a few more times there. But, I really liked it. It was a game that I've been wanting to play for a while. I had a bit of expectation, but it met it and exceeded those expectations just because it really is two games in one. It's that worker placement strategy game, but it's also that economic strategy game with your own companies and moving money to your personal wealth. And yeah, we didn't really get into it, but you can also do a hostile takeover where you buy more shares than the person who currently owns the company. So you take over that company, and or you can dump the share price of a company so that it's not worth as much. We didn't really get into any of that, but I'm guessing that comes with future plays.
Or if Jules plays.
If Jules plays. Very true.
It sounds like the decision space in that game opens up then as the rounds go on. So it's no wonder that it's long. Is it with the rounds longer and longer?
Yeah, well, the turns themselves are pretty quick. Like the worker placement style of things, you can have a little bit of AP, but it wasn't terrible. And you gain more workers as the game goes on. So it still stays relatively tight, obviously with a few more spaces being available. The extra workers sort of tightens it up a smidge. But where the game gets its length is that at the end of every round, you pay out your investors, and you start off with a company each. But I think we had, by the end of it, I think we had seven companies. So there was three more companies that were purchased throughout the game. So you're doing that step seven times. Now, I shouldn't say drags it on, because the nature of the game that people own shares in different companies, it's not like you've done yours and now you just sit back and do nothing for 5 minutes. You're still getting money from other companies as it goes around the table. And turn order is super important as well. So both with selling the shares, there's a turn order, and then there's a different turn order for the game. So you can manipulate, you can go to a space that puts you to the top of that turn order for the game. Which is really handy, because you can, if you're last in turn order and then you go to that space, you'll then have another turn straight away. It's like an immediate change, which is really cool. But then, the selling of the shares also has its own particular turn order. So getting in early for some things is because it's not just selling the shares. It's also when you can purchase shares in other companies. So being able to go first in that phase is really handy.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're ready for an 18XX game now.
Well, look, I've broken down some barriers of things that I didn't think I'd play before. So why not? Bring it on. Bring it on. I mean, the artwork is phenomenal as well. So there's that. But I will say one of the coolest things that happened is after we played this game. So like I said, the company that I invested in that Shane was running was Florsheim Shoes. So I've invested in this company heavily, and I remember just seeing in the back of my head going, I'm sure I've seen those shops around. And then 2 days later, I was shopping for school shoes for my kids, and I've walked past the Florsheim shoes, and I've literally had the thought, I should probably buy from them because then I'll get some sort of random kickback.
So, you probably get a discount being a shareholder.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, but unfortunately, they don't really do kids' school shoes. It's not really their market. So, that was good fun though. Yeah, really, really enjoyable game. It's not for, I feel like it's a game that's not for everyone, but I'm definitely keen to play more of it. So that's City of the Big Shoulders. What about yourself, Sarah?
Well, I actually. It's a Stronghold Games. I swear I'm not sucking up.
We accept pandering.
Okay. All right, cool. I'm sucking up then. No, I've been playing Nova Luna. And the funny thing about this is that I don't own it anymore, technically, because what happened is a friend borrowed it and they liked it so much that they then ordered me another copy because my board game supplier, my dealer, is living around the corner from me. So it's really easy for me to pick up games. So she kindly said, can we keep this one and you just go get another one? And so that happened. And then it actually happened a second time. I lent it out again and my friend said, and I told her the story. I said that this is actually my second copy of the game, and if you like it so much, you might want to keep this one. And I was joking, and she actually did. So now I'm Nova Luna-less again, and I've got to wait for my third copy.
I think that second one's on you, I think, Sarah. You planned it.
Yeah, I did. I set it up for that, but yeah, I didn't. So it is a really great game, and it's an abstract game, and it's sort of so it's by Uwe Rosenberg, who. He's sort of known for doing, you know, the big farming games and his polyamino games as well. So he does sort of shorter, lighter polyamino games. And Nova Luna grabbed me because it wasn't either of those styles. So it was something different. And it's kind of similar mechanically to two games. It's sort of a mix of Patchwork in a way and Habitats, which was by another designer, and he and Uwe actually credited him, Corne van Morsel, I believe his name is, and his I'm probably butchering these names, so he designed Habitats, and it's really, really clever and it's really fun, because one of the things that I enjoy with board games is if it's not just playing for points. Like, I don't mind playing for points. I'm a huge fan of Euros. It's fine. But when you play something that's you're not playing for points and it's a bit different, it just, I don't know, it sort of grabs you and it takes you on a different journey, which I really like. So, and how it's like patchwork basically is there's three tiles that you can choose from on your turn. So you choose one of these tiles and you'll place that in your tableau. And the tiles usually have a couple of things on them. So it'll always have a number. And that number is how much you move up in the turn order track. And always the person who's at the back of that track will play their turn. So you kind of want to be careful of taking a tile that's 6 or 7, because then you're going to go really far ahead. And it might be that the people behind you get more turns that way than you, and therefore more tiles. So you've got to manage that. But the other thing is on the tiles, there's these little goals that you need to meet. So, for example, you might take a tile that has a one yellow circle on it and a red and a blue circle on it. And what this means is that tile that you've placed in front of you needs to be, it has two goals. It wants to be next to a yellow. So you'll need to place a yellow tile next to it to fulfill that goal. And it wants to be next to a red and a blue as well. So if you fill that, you get to put another goal disc on it. And you have 21 goal discs, and it's the first to complete 21 goals on their tableau. And it's really, really simple. And the clever part as well, the way it balances, is if you do take a tile that's going to push you up in the turn order really far, which is not ideal, they usually have three goals on them, which means that they're stronger. You can complete more goals with that tile. So there's a real balance there. And I find that it is always so tense and tight near the end, because just about everyone is ready to fulfill their last, you know, few goals, especially when I play, like me and my partner, where we tend to be like really just down to the wire. It's like, oh, I just need one more turn and then I'll be able to do it, you know, and then he might pip me to the post. So yeah, it's really fun. There's only four colors in the game, so it's quite simple to actually, Steve, for you, I don't know how the color blindness thing would go. But yeah, it's just four different colors, and you want to basically group them together, because some of the tiles they will ask for, like you might have a light blue tile that asks for three red, and that's going to be harder to do. But the other thing you can do is you can link. So even if you've just got three red tiles and they're off in one direction, as long as they're touching each other, they count. So they don't actually have to surround that tile necessarily if you've grouped them together. So that's really clever as well. So I try to tend to make like snakes of all the different colors and then find the right tiles to connect to them and fulfill like a few goals at a time. It's really brilliant. I absolutely love sort of spatial puzzles, and this one not being the typical Polyomino one, it was just something really different. It looks great. Yeah, and it's just one of those games you can teach anyone. It's really approachable. So I like it. I can totally see why it got nominated. And it won, right? Didn't it win the Spiel des Jahres in the end?
I think Pitchers won.
Oh, Pitchers won. That's right. Yes. Well, I can see why it was nominated. It was fantastic.
Ooh.
Love it. Pitchers is all right, but yeah. yeah, so that's Nova Luna.
Very good. Well, that only leaves us with one. So, Sydney, would you like to tell us what your sizzling game is?
Yeah, so actually when I heard about this segment, I was kind of worried because, as you mentioned, I mostly play the same prototype over and over again and don't get a chance to play a lot of non-IBC Stronghold games. And when I say non-IBC Stronghold games, I mean non-games that haven't come out yet. I don't even really play the line that we've already produced. And I made a joke about it to Nick that I've only been playing prototypes, and he said, "Well, let's check on the timeline, and maybe you'll be able to talk about one of those prototypes." So my sizzling game hasn't come out yet, I believe by the time that this is posted, it will be announced. It's getting announced very, very soon, or has already been announced. It is Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition, which is sort of a
hard game. Steve, pick yourself back up.
Yeah, yeah, let him breathe on that one there, Sydney.
Hey, it's Steve from the editing room floor here. Now, Sydney just announced her sizzle, and while we were very intrigued and very happy to listen to her talk all about it, it turns out that she was just so relaxed hanging with the barbecue crew that she divulged information that she shouldn't have so soon. So we are going to play the Sydney sizzle on the 21st of January episode of the podcast in full, but for now just sit back and spend the next week twiddling your thumbs waiting to hear the announcements. Now let's get back to the show.
That's fantastic. Well, that is all of our sizzles. I'm glad I went to you last, Sydney. That wasn't planned, but that was fantastic.
It was worth all that Eon's End, you know, the Eon's End, well, you were listening to that and you got your...
Well, that's it. I came into this episode thinking, Sarah and Dan are going to love this. You know, it's really about the games that they love, and now we're finishing with the games that I love. This is fantastic.
Something for everyone.
Yeah. That's right. But we do have one more segment to go to, which we'll go to now, which is Swearing an Oath. Now, today I'm actually going to step out of this one because a little bit of behind the curtain stuff. We've actually recorded this episode before the episode that will come before it on the actual podcast app. So that's a bit confusing. So I actually don't know what I have sworn for my oath. So I'm just going to pretend that it didn't happen, and I'll just make up for that on the next week. Sarah and Dan, I'll start with you guys. Sarah, what was your last oath? Were you successful, and what's next?
I smashed it. Yay! So I had to play The Gallerist by Vital Lacerda, and I played half a game. I started at 11 p.m. and I was playing solo, and I was sort of teaching myself the rules, and I couldn't get it finished because I started at 11 p.m. It's a long game. But then I played it again day before yesterday, and it was so good. I'm not a huge solo gamer, and because it was a long game, I sort of had it set up on the table. I played it for a bit, then I had to do something, then I came back, played it for a bit, and it actually worked really well like that. I remembered what I was doing when I left it, which is good, and so it was great. Like, no one was there at the table going, hey, where are you going? Like, I could just come into it and leave whenever. And it was so brilliant. I don't want to talk about it too much because I think it's going to be a sizzle. But it's along the lines of, I'm not going to say it makes sense because we've said that too many times about On Mars and Vinyos, but I will say that it did feel thematic, like all of Vital's games, you're taking on this role. So in this, you're the gallerist and you're running an art gallery, and everything you do in that game is thematic, and it's brilliant. I really liked it. It was challenging. I got 2 out of 4 of the objectives for the solo game, so I didn't really win, but still had a great time. It was great.
Excellent. And so what's next?
I've got so many games on my shelf of shame now. Because I've been naughty and I've used my purchase pen too much. So I think the next one for me is Bargain Quest, because that's been on the shelf for a while now.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been on the shelf since September. So I'd really like to play Bargain Quest. I saw someone in the Discord posted photos. They played it during the Christmas break. It looks awesome. It just looks like a riot, really fun. So I, Sarah Green, swear to play Bargain Quest by the next time I'm on the podcast.
Nice one. What about yourself, Dan?
My oath was Maracaibo, and played that and loved it. It's been a game that's been talked about quite often on this podcast. I think you've played it several times as well, haven't you, Steve?
Yeah, but only solo, but I really enjoy it.
So I played it solo as well against the Automa. I really like when the Automa has a name. So Gene, it's because I lost convincingly the first time I played it. So I was constantly just going, "Ah, oh, Gene," was shaking my fist in the air, going, "Gene." By the time it took me a little while just to understand the rule and wrap my head around it all, because it is quite a sort of a sprawling game with so many different things to do. Which is actually one of the things that I really enjoyed about the game. But when I finally got, and I lost convincingly, it was just after midnight. And I went, no, I'm going again. So I reset the board and I played a second time, and I did actually chalk up a win. But I really enjoyed it, and I think I've mentioned on the podcast in the past that I am starting to get a real taste for these sort of work placement games, because they were never in my wheelhouse when I first joined. I was always sort of playing the co-op games and the solo games. But no, Maracaibo, really, really enjoyed it, and I hope to get to the table again soon and play it with other people. Although it does play very well with the Automa.
Yeah, I find it's like a race against the Automa, because the Automa really pushes the end of round.
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of deliberately leave spots for it to stop so that
it'd be so nice to just take your time and just visit each village and each city. But yeah, you're right. It is a race to try and get to the end before the Automa does. And yeah. And so anyway, my next oath, I'm going to go back to my solo roots, and I've got a game that I bought probably 2 years ago, and I just uncovered it the other day.
Oh, a 2 year old?
Yeah, it's been a while, and I bought it because I really love the artwork. It's The Lost Expedition. Has anyone ever played this?
No,
I haven't.
The artwork really reminds me of Tintin, the old graphic novel Tintin. It's a deck game. It's a lot of hand management, and you've got resources and things, and it's basically an exploration through a jungle. That's about all I know of it. It's fairly light in terms of weight, but I, Dan Harris, swear that I will be playing The Lost Expedition by the time next time on the podcast, and I hope to tell you more about it then.
Did you buy it because it looks like Tintin?
I absolutely did.
All right, well, Sydney and Nick, I'll invite you guys to take part in this madness. Obviously, you won't be on the show next week unless you want to come back. And
oh, yeah, we can talk about Aeon's End again.
Or Terraforming Mars, either way. But if you would like, you can swear an oath yourselves, and then when you get a chance to play these games or whatever else, if you could just tag the Board Game Barbecue and post a picture, and then we can celebrate your success. Would either of you guys like to take part?
Sure, I'll do it. I don't have a shelf of shame. I try to keep my collection as like kind of small as possible, and in some case necessary. And also, I just moved into a new house, so my shelving unit, as of like 3 hours ago, didn't have any games on it. But I put it in the right place, and I have been unpacking and throwing them on there. And I did run across a game that I had been thinking about playing. I have played it hundreds of times. It's Aeon's End Legacy. My girlfriend, Lisa, who I mentioned earlier, she is a video gamer, and she has played some lighter games with me, like The Crew, and we've played Time's Up and a couple other games, but we played through Battle of Hogwarts because she's a big Harry Potter fan. So she has played a deck builder, but Aeon Legacy is certainly a different kind of deck builder, and definitely the Nemesis is like more complicated than I think the baddies in HP Battle of Hogwarts. So I want to play through that with her because I think that Legacy will ease her into it and see if she likes it. She's heard a ton about it. She definitely knows a lot of character names because we'll talk about them with her around, etc. But I think that she'll enjoy playing it. And I don't think I've told her that that's my plan for her yet. So
she can just listen to this podcast and find out that way.
I'm sure she already does.
Yeah, she's real tapped into the board game podcast.
She's heaviest game she plays Harry Potter, and she's like, yeah, but I listen to all the podcasts. That's right. Yeah.
Australia as well.
Fantastic. Oh, that's awesome. I wish you all the best for that, because that would be a big step up, obviously. So what about yourself, Sydney?
I guess I'll follow Nick's example of being very self-absorbed with the company, because the only thing I can really think of that's sort of on a quote-unquote shame shelf that I should be playing is to get back to the prototype of the simpler to set up, quick setup Aeon's End sort of derivative game that we're working on, because we worked on it for a while. Many, many months ago, and then we got so consumed with all the work we had to do on Aeon's End Legacy of Graveholds and Ares Expedition that we haven't gotten it to table again in a very, very long time. And it's sort of representative of me finishing up all the editing work I have to do on Legacy of Graveholds story. And once that's done, we can start playtesting the simpler Aeon's End setup prototype again, and that will mean we're moving on to the next project, which is always very exciting. So hopefully that will happen soon.
And I'm assuming it doesn't have a name yet.
No, it's got some tentative name, so definitely nothing serious enough that we can call it by it. We've been just calling it Simplified.
Okay. Fair enough. Is that is there a time frame for that one yet?
Yeah.
Is it too early?
I think that we would like to launch it Q3 or Q4 of this year.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We've started getting art, and we definitely have like all the pieces fleshed out. There's still some like kind of overarching product stuff to do and some development, but it's something that actually the original designer of Aeon's End started working on it. Whew, this was like two or three years ago, and it went through several iterations, and we talked about what the product should be, and we actually looked into getting different IP for it. And we just kind of settled on, like, I made a breakthrough a little over a year ago about how to do the market, the like supply cards, and how to do the Nemesis deck. And then a guy who works with us, Will Sobel, who's like an independent contractor for us, he does marketing for it's Modiphius now, I think. Mm-hmm. So he lives here in Indy with us, and he does playtesting with us, and we hired him to do development on it while Sydney and I could focus on Ares Expedition and Legacy of Graveholds. And now that we've gotten those two off our plates, for the next 2 or 3 months, we're probably really going to dive in and tune it, because I think, like I said, most of the stuff is like the parts are there. They just need the tweaking to get done. But the art's underway. So yeah, I would say that like it'll probably be on Kickstarter in September, October, something like that.
Okay. Well, it sounds like I've got my years planned out.
Yeah.
My year in Kickstarter planned out.
All right. So, well, thank you for taking part in that. It'd be awesome obviously they're prototypes. I don't know how much you can show, but to see you guys, well, obviously not Aeon's End Legacy, but to see you guys succeed in your oaths, and that goes for you too, Sarah and Dan. I'll be back on next week with an oath. But we'll finish the show there. That's a wrap for us. Well, just before we go, though, we just want to let everyone know a few things. So firstly, if you'd like to join our community, there's a few ways you can do that. The Board Game Barbecue community on Facebook is a great place to go, as well as our Discord channel, which is just Board Game Barbecue again. There's a link in the show notes for that. That's where we join together to play heaps of games on Tabletop Simulator, Tabletopia, Board Game Arena, etc., but also just chat about board games and other things in the community as well. There's a new channel in there that's all about painting and 3D printing, so lots of information there, as well as our website, which is boardgamebarbecue.com.au, boardgamebarbecue.com. And there you'll find links to every episode we've ever done, some bios about each of the presenters, as well as links to our merch store if you're interested in that, or also our Patreon if you would like to support us going forward with the podcast. But before we go any further, I think it's important to throw back to Sydney and Nick to firstly say thank you, but also if there's anything that they would like to share about either how you can be involved with Stronghold or follow them, etc. So firstly, thank you, Sydney and Nick.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
And thank you, Sarah and Dan, and that will do us for the show.
Wow, what a show.
And we'll see you on the next podcast. Cheers.